The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Toward the end, Blanche, I think, wanting to tie it all together and end on something of a high note, said, quote, "President Trump is being very careful to comply with Your Honor's rules." The judge was having none of it. He stopped him. He said, "You, Mr. Blanche, you are losing all credibility. I have to tell you that right now. You are losing all credibility with the court."
It's the Lawfare podcast, Trump's Trials and Tribulations. I'm Benjamin Wittes with Anna Bauer, Quinta Jurassic, Tyler McBrien, and Roger Parloff.
Blanche even said, "That's democracy," or something to that effect in the opening. And so that was a little bit surprising that they're taking these kind of known facts and trying to cast it in a different light of saying hush money payments are legal. It's totally normal for campaigns to try to affect what information voters are getting.
Today we're discussing what's new in all the different cases. It's the Lawfare podcast, Trump's Trials and Tribulations, checking in on all the cases. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's Trump Trials and Tribulations. I am here, as always, in the Brown University studio, coming to you from the Watson Center, which, as you know, is a place that I don't work. We are joined, of course, by Roger Parloff from the Scott Studio, Tyler McBrien from the Martha Stewart kitchen studio, Anna Bauer from the Lawfare content house in Tribeca, and of course, from the Brookings Institution, it's Quinta Jurassic before the endless scream pillow. We got a lot to talk about, guys, and just so that you all know, we have done virtually no preparation of any kind for this live stream because we've all been really busy. So we're winging it. And this is what we look like when we are really winging it. So we're going to start with tomorrow's oral argument. We're going to wing it with an event that hasn't happened yet. Quinta, we got an oral argument tomorrow in the presidential immunity case. What do we know and what are we expecting?
So this is the long-awaited oral argument, as you said, in the case litigating whether or not Trump is immune as a former president from prosecutions for acts that occurred during his presidency. I should also say, I apologize for my voice. I'm getting over a bit of a cold, so I'm a little croaky right now. So this is, I think at this point, listeners are probably pretty familiar because we've been covering this since it came up through the district court, I want to say this fall. The very short version is that Trump is arguing that there is a total categorical immunity on his part for the acts that are charged in the January 6th indictment. And Jack Smith is saying there is no immunity at all. Now, Smith, interestingly, in his brief, which I am trying to pull up right now, apologies, suggests that, well, you know, maybe if the court wanted to find that there's some immunity in some instances, it could do that. But what it should then do is kick it back down to the district court and allow the district court to kind of hash out which of the charges fall within or outside that immunity during pretrial and trial proceedings, meaning that essentially the case will get back on track, which I think is important because, of course, the subtext here is that the January 6th case has been paused while the Supreme Court is considering Trump's immunity argument. The court, I believe, agreed to take up this case, I want to say, in February, having a briefing in March, April, and then a hearing at the end of April is actually pretty quick for the court for a case it agreed to take up in February. But given that we really have a ticking clock before the election, that sort of every lost week for Jack Smith matters a great deal. So I think I at least will be looking out not only for how the justices seem to be considering the questions raised, but also how they're considering this question of speed and if it even comes up at all, or if everyone kind of treats it as verboten, you know, something that you shouldn't say outright, except for Trump, who I'm sure will be more than happy to make that point. I think the other thing that is worth noting is that I think it's pretty fair to say that the Lawfare team does not think that highly of Trump's legal argumentation here. The goal is really delay on his part, and so I would expect to see the justices be pretty unsympathetic to his point of view. So I'll definitely be watching to see if there's anyone who seems like they might actually be gettable for him on the substance.
If I can pipe in a little bit, just a one note that we'll have some good attorneys tomorrow. It'll be John Sauer again, who handled the Anderson case, the Section 3 case for Trump, and was very good. And Michael Dreeben for the special counsel's office. I'll leave the substance to Quinta, and I'll just add a couple notes on timing. Something that you can kick yourself over there. If the court had not granted cert on February 28th, it could have gone back to Chutkan then. Remember, this was the second opportunity. It could have granted cert, you know, a month or two before, a couple months before the D.C. Circuit got it. It said, no, let's go through the whole shebang. And so it could have gone back if they hadn't granted cert the second time. And we could have started jury selection May 28th. Imagine that. Yeah. And
Roger, why are you doing this to me?
So you would have had a verdict before the election, and you would have had a judgment before the inauguration, which is also very important. That's no longer possible. So judgment means that Trump could not direct his attorney general to throw this out if he becomes president. So if the ruling comes down June 1st, which is relatively fast, I guess, jury selection could start August 28th, if everything goes as fast as possible. And that would mean a verdict probably the week of October 28th, which is a week before the November 5th election.
And so I just want to say right in the, I forget her phrase, the zone of cosmic awful on Quinta's...
It was the black
the
hole,
black
of,
hole
awful.
Of awful in Quinta's diagram, which I remind you all is up for auction on the Lawfare Give Butter. You can have the original Quinta diagram.
Yeah, and then if the ruling comes out at the end of the term, June 30th, after 206 days of delay, if you go back to when the appellate process began in December, then you would conceivably start the trial on the jury selection September 26th. So you would probably get a verdict at the end of November, after the election. So anyway, things are bleak.
Yeah, so that's cheerful. I will say one note. Just digging into the lore, if you will, for the real Trump heads out there. It is interesting that Michael Dreeben is arguing this case. So for listeners who aren't familiar, he is a longtime presence in the Justice Department's Office of the Solicitor General, sort of the guru of criminal appellate litigation. He was on the Mueller team. And why I mention it here in particular is, I think, is widely believed, if not like 100% confirmed, to have written the section of the Mueller report that had to do with grappling with these very same questions of presidential immunity. Although in that case, it had to do with the questions were a bit different because it involved the prospects for prosecuting a sitting president. So since then, he'd left the Justice Department and then returned to participate in Smith's investigation. So I do think it's interesting that he's kind of come back out of retirement. I imagine him a little bit like Luke Skywalker at the beginning of Star Wars, where he's rediscovered, he's back in action, to kind of, discuss this, this issue in front of the Supreme Court. And then the other thing is just, he's a, superb oral advocate, and the justices all know him really well because he's been doing this for so long. So this is really the person who you want to be arguing your case if you're Jack Smith. And I think we noted previously he was reportedly in the courtroom during oral arguments in Fisher v. United States, the other January 6th related Supreme Court case that we discussed last week. So it'll be interesting to see if that comes up at all.
One curiosity is that James Pierce is on the brief here as part of the special counsel team. He was also on the brief in Fisher as part of the DOJ team. And I hadn't really known this, but you can wear a DOJ hat one day and a special counsel hat the next day. Anyway, that's a curiosity for you.
Yeah, so I will just say about the oral advocacy in this case, it is likely to be, as Roger says, extremely strong on both sides. And I would say one other thing about Dreeben, that he not only, he did something else in the Mueller investigation, which has something which bears on this, which is not merely the immunity questions, but also the questions of when presidential acts can and cannot be considered criminal, can be covered at all by criminal law. And this was an issue that Mueller struggled with a lot in the context of the obstruction statutes. And Dreeben wrote a famous memo that was kind of an appendix to the Mueller report on this question that is closely related to the question that is being presented today. It didn't present in the form of immunity. There were, of course, the other questions in the Mueller report about can you charge a sitting president, of which Mueller determined that you can't. But there are other questions like if the president fires the FBI director or dangles a pardon, right? Can that be cognizable under the obstruction statute? And the memo on that subject in the Mueller report is written by Mike Dreeben, who, by the way...
Yeah, sorry, I should say that's the section that I was referring to. I mistakenly called it immunity.
I thought you were talking about the sitting president components, as in Mueller's decision that because he couldn't prosecute a sitting president, he wouldn't.
Now we're really going into the weeds. That as well. But the portion that you're discussing is what I had in mind.
And I see. Okay.
I will take responsibility for my slip up, but also say that I do think the fact that I slipped up, maybe it's just because I'm sick, but I also think that it points to how intertwined these issues are.
Yes, they're closely intertwined. I also think, if you are, so if you're an aficionado of good oral arguments, you will get one tomorrow.
And we'll have a live something or other after it as well.
Yes. So in the spirit, I will be, of course, in court in New York with Anna. Quinta and Roger, what is planned tomorrow for the for a live debrief?
I think at 1 o'clock we're going to give we'll have a live a Lawfare Live, or
yeah, and, that's correct.
I think our colleague Alan will be with us.
Alan Rosenstein will be joining us, and our other colleague, associate editor Haman Hahn, will be in the courtroom. And we'll be writing a dispatch about what she sees.
So tomorrow is a momentous day in the history of Lawfare. It is the first day we will ever have two live YouTube live streams / podcasts. And so, you know, you can see the growth of Lawfare with your own eyes and ears. All right, let's talk briefly about timing of this. We've already mentioned how much it has delayed the trial, but Roger and Quinta, do you see any reason for optimism that there will be, I mean, we're presumably going to get a ruling by the end of the term, but that's 2 months from now. Do you see any reason to think we could have a quicker than that disposition of this?
I mean, I'm not holding out hope. Like, anything could happen, but I would not be surprised if they wait as long as humanly possible and then say, it's outrageous that he's seeking immunity. What a terrible anti-American idea. Also, there's no way he's going to be able to have a trial before the election. Bye. And then head off for summer vacation.
Roger, do you dissent from that?
I don't. I don't think they... You know, it sounds cynical, but I don't think they would have taken the case except to make it impossible for this to get done before the election. So I'm not optimistic. And I think it's also possible they might send it back for more fact findings and allow those to be appealed to really, really make it impossible for this to even start before the election, which is sort of what they did with the Vance versus Trump case. They sent it back. There were more findings. It came up again. There was a motion for a stay. They waited on the stay for like 4 months to decide the stay. I mean,
And I should say part of why we are having the Manhattan trial so late in the game, because it took so long to get those documents.
It's also why we're having, and it's why we're having this trial instead of the trial Pomerantz, Mark Pomerantz wanted to, and Cy Vance wanted to bring. They wanted to bring a different case, a criminal version of the civil case we saw in Engeron's court. They were too late in the game, and Cy Vance left, and then Alvin Bragg didn't want to pursue that case, and so we switched to the hush money case.
All right. Speaking of cases that are ongoing as opposed to cases that are not ongoing, we had the start of a criminal case before a jury against the former president on Monday. It continued on Tuesday. It is on break for Justice Mershon's midweek Shabbat, also known as Wednesday today. Anna, you and I were there Monday. Tyler and Anna were there Tuesday. What do y'all think? What are your impressions of the action so far?
Tyler, you go first.
Well, I was going to say, maybe if you want to start with some opening statement analysis, and then I can take us into Tuesday.
Yeah. So I think that opening statements, I actually thought that both the prosecution and the defense delivered some pretty effective opening statements. And we talk about the opening statements in depth in our dispatch. So I won't focus so much on the substance, and we'll focus a little bit more on just kind of some observations about it. I think that, you know, the prosecution set out a compelling case of this being this catch and kill scheme that was kind of used to subvert the type of information that people were getting during the 2016 election. I was a little bit surprised that there wasn't more reference to the specific, like, even though there was this big theme of influencing the 2016 election, there wasn't more specific reference to what this object crime might be. As folks might remember from our previous discussions, the prosecution has to prove not only that there was falsification of a business record on all of these counts, but also that it was done with an intent to defraud, and that intent to defraud included an intent to conceal or to aid or commit another crime. And in the pretrial proceedings, Justice Merchan approved these different, you know, three different theories that other crime could be, and that's, you know, known as the object crime. And it could be a violation of New York state tax law. It could be a violation of federal campaign finance law. It could be this other provision in New York state law that makes it unlawful to have a conspiracy to promote a candidate to office through unlawful means. And so those are the kind of the three theories. But we didn't really initially on that first day get a clear idea of which one of those theories the prosecution thinks maybe is their best shot. It might be that they think all of them are strong. I don't know. But it did seem like, you know, the opening statements from the prosecution did not necessarily focus on any one specific theory and had more of just a theme of election influence and interference. And so potentially that suggests that it could be that a New York state election law. And the next day, of course, we did have, you know, the prosecution talking about or seeming to reference that New York state election law. So, but it just is a little bit surprising that there wasn't a specific reference to the prosecution's opening. Then we also had in the defense opening, I thought that Todd Blanche did a good job. It was a little bit surprising, as we write in our piece that's coming out. We have a big dispatch of what's happened over the past 2 days that will be up on Lawfare hopefully soon. And it was a little bit surprising that, you know, Blanche took a different strategy than maybe what people thought. There has a long been talk about Trump, you know, saying, oh, I was trying to not influence an election, but, you know, just wanted to hide this from my wife, these indiscretions from my wife, basically. There has long been talk of basically, you know, maybe it could be that they try to deny that some of this happened, or that, you know, deny certain elements of, or focus on denying certain elements of the crime. But it was more that Blanche seemed to kind of, you know, maybe wasn't denying major factual elements within the prosecution's story, but was just casting them in a different light. So not, you know, fully saying there was no scheme orchestrated to have these hush money payments that then would influence the information that voters are getting. Instead, you know, it's the kind of thing where they're just saying that is perfectly fine. At one point, I think Blanche even said that's democracy or something to that effect in the opening. And so that was a little bit surprising that they're taking these kind of known facts, and they might not have any choice in that regard because they just feel that it's going to be very easy for the prosecution to prove up some of those allegations about the hush money scheme. But trying to cast it in a different light of saying hush money payments are legal and it's totally normal for campaigns to try to, you know, affect what information voters are getting. I do think there were a few times when he really got like his flow was interrupted because of some of these objections that were being made. Usually, even as a kind of matter of etiquette, counsel typically tries to refrain from objecting unless they really need to in an opening statement. Here there were like just a number, at least more than six, which is pretty unusual to see, at least in trials that I've seen, is pretty unusual to see more than that number in a case. Although I remember, Roger, at the Oath Keepers trial during openings, there were a significant number of objections during openings. But so that kind of interrupted his flow. But overall, I thought that Blanche did an effective job. But Tyler, maybe you can talk about how that kind of changed, at least in some respects, the next day.
Yeah, I think a lot of that momentum or goodwill that Blanche had built up from Monday was taken from him on Tuesday, which began with, I would say, fireworks, and the fireworks probably continued throughout the day. We began the day with a contempt hearing. The prosecution filed a motion to try to convince Judge Merchan to hold Trump in contempt of court for violating the judge's April 1st gag order. They initially alleged three violations and then tacked on an additional seven. And then they even, the prosecution, when they began arguing in the hearing, had referenced an 11th alleged violation that Trump had made just outside the courtroom in the hallway pen or just outside live on TV. These allegations had to do with statements or posts, rather, that Trump had made regarding witnesses Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels. Eight of them were on his Truth Social page, and two of them were on his official campaign page. I think the prosecution had a much easier job here. They went through the 10 allegations, and they also had to argue that they were done willfully and in full knowledge of Trump, which is a lot easier when Trump truths the word gag order seemingly every day. And Blanche had a really hard time. He was repeatedly asked by Justice Merchan what Trump's posts were a response to, because part of the defense argument was that these were responses to political attacks, which, as they argue, should be carved out from the order. But Blanche couldn't really do that. And Justice Merchan was getting quite, I would say, agitated and impatient. I pulled up the transcript because I want to get this pretty shocking quote right. Toward the end, Blanche, I think wanting to tie it all together and end on something of a high note, said, quote, "President Trump is being very careful to comply with Your Honor's rules." And the judge was having none of it. He stopped him. He said, "You, Mr. Blanche, you are losing all credibility. I have to tell you that right now. You are losing all credibility with the court." And I think, Roger, Anna, Ben, Quinta, you've all seen more trials than I have, but I think that's bad. That's not something you want to hear if you're the defense.
Although I will say that at this point in a trial, it is more important to have credibility with the jury than with the judge. And, you know, Blanche may have made the decision that in the tripartite relationship that he has to build between, you know, he has to be in the middle of this weird relationship between his client, the jury, and the judge. The one that he can actually afford to alienate is the judge, because there are appellate courts, because he gets all the benefits of the doubt, because, you know, all of those things. So he can kind of piss off Judge Merchan if he wants, but he cannot piss off the jury. And of course, cannot piss off the client, because the client is so mercurial. I mean, look, I will just say that I thought that this, the contrast between Blanche on Monday and Blanche on Tuesday was pretty remarkable. And I do want to say a couple of words about what Blanche was able to pull off on Monday, because I actually think it's worth noting. The whole prosecution theory of this case rests on three things. One is that there's a catch and kill deal with respect to stuff in the run-up with the National Enquirer and the estimable David Pecker in the run-up to the election in 2016, and that they kill a bunch of potentially really damaging stories, including but not limited to the Stormy Daniels story right after the Access Hollywood tape. The second component is that Trump promised to reimburse Michael Cohen for the payments that he made, and that Michael Cohen and Alan Weisselberg cooked up this scheme to do these reimbursements through this fictitious form of payment for legal services. And the third is that they then executed that through what's actually the crime here, which is a series of payments that the records of which had to be falsified. And I thought it's a 35-minute opening statement, and Blanche promised, and again, we'll see whether it was all bluster or whether he can actually do some of this through cross-examination, but he basically, as Anna pointed out, I really expected the argument to be a kind of John Edwards defense. You know, he was just trying to keep this from his pregnant wife, or, you know, dying of cancer wife in the John Edwards case, or Melania, who had been pregnant at the time in this case. And that's not the defense. The defense is, yeah, hell yeah, there was a catch and kill scheme. It's called information control. And, you know, we were trying to influence an election. There was a campaign on. Are you kidding? And by the way, there's nothing illegal about NDAs. There's nothing illegal about catch and kill schemes. And when the prosecution talks about this as a conspiracy to illegally interfere with the election, they're wrong. And I think he's actually got a point on that latter point. It's not clear to me when Colangelo talks about this as an illegal scheme, what's illegal about the scheme? They haven't charged anything being illegal about the scheme, nor have they alleged anything that's on its face illegal. So that's point one that I thought Blanche's opening was really surprising about. Point two is, you might call it, the sometimes a legal bill is just a legal bill. Like, they're going to try to argue that Michael Cohen was actually just Trump's personal lawyer, and he was, you know, billing 12 times for $35,000 on a kind of retainer arrangement for actual legal services. And then three, and this is the kicker, that the only evidence that the prosecution really has that this isn't true, other than Weisselberg, I suppose, is the testimony of Michael Cohen himself. And both he and Stormy Daniels are extremely difficult witnesses whom the jury shouldn't believe. And so I actually thought it was a remarkably coherent defense argument. It's exactly as compelling as they can justify it with respect to evidence over the course of the next few weeks. But I did think the speed with which Blanche went from that to, you know, you have no credibility in this court, sir, you know, from the judge, is really amazing. And I was impressed with Monday, and Tuesday was that was a bad day.
I will say that the Todd Blanche that I've seen several times in various jurisdictions that these cases have been brought is more similar to the Todd Blanche that we've seen, that we saw on the second day, as opposed to the, you know, jury Todd Blanche. So it is really interesting to see how the jury has that influence on the advocacy.
And how do you, what do you attribute that to? I mean, like we've made some fun of him at times, both here and in South Florida, for kind of bombastic, overly broad arguments that are not really sustainable, both in this case and in the South Florida case. And we've noted that he gets away with a lot of that in front of Judge Cannon for important other reasons. But like, what do you make of the sort of two faces of Todd Blanche here?
I mean, I think a big part of it is client. It relates to who his client is. I mean, it's Donald Trump, and you as an attorney want to keep your client happy. But I also think that a big part of it in South Florida, at least, which is where Blanche, other than the New York case, has made the most argument before the judge. I think that specifically is very unique to Judge Cannon herself, because there might be this idea that he can maybe get away with more in front of Judge Cannon than he maybe could another judge. But still, it was the same Todd Blanche who was before Justice Marchand, basically, who I could see, you know, him saying similar things that he would there as he has with Judge Cannon. So I'm not really sure, Ben, but I think that a big part of it has to do with just the fact that there is no jury. And of course, you know, you're going to kind of switch your demeanor and, you know, you will have worked with jury consultants. You're going to know you might have done jury exercises and tried out different, you know, advocacy strategies. And so you maybe have already decided, you know, what is or would not be permissible in terms of your performance in front of a jury.
All right. So the other thing that happened this week in the case, of course, is that we heard a bit from my favorite character yet to present. And I don't think he will be topped, honestly. David Pecker, who just, I mean, is a treasure, and I love him. Tyler, give us a rundown of the David Pecker testimony. I'm really sorry that you did not get to hear him cackle yesterday, because it was a thing of beauty.
As am I, but I did get to hear you imitating him cackling, so that was also very nice.
Not the same thing, as Anna, who has heard both, can tell you.
But yeah, happy to give it a rundown. And then with apologies, I'll have to drop off for another podcast recording after I do so. But I think the most interesting part of Pecker's testimony yesterday, and again, I missed the first, I guess, 20 minutes of it on Monday, was essentially the way in which he walked us through how these catch and kill schemes worked with pretty granular detail. We even got to take a look at what is called a source agreement, essentially the contract between AMI, which publishes the National Enquirer, and Dino Sajudin, who is the doorman who claimed to have a story about Trump fathering a daughter out of wedlock with a maid who was employed under the Trump Organization, and just how close the contact was between Pecker and Cohen, who was acting as a proxy for Trump. So we heard about how that catch and kill scheme worked. We heard about how it worked in the case of Karen McDougal, about which it seemed that Cohen was under a lot more strain and pressure to get an answer from Pecker about the veracity of that story and whether there was a resolution there. And then we also heard about just, I guess, a lot of the details of these agreements. So the price of $30,000 paid to a source with a story that was false was extremely atypical. Pecker said the normal price to pay for one of these agreements would be anywhere from $250 to the higher end being $10,000 for a bigger celebrity. And those were for true stories. And then similarly, the what So Sojourner would have to pay if he broke the terms of the agreement was $1 million, which is this exorbitant amount of money that was also atypical in terms of damages. So it was fascinating, honestly, to see how what he calls checkbook journalism plays out, or how it plays out day to day.
I just want to say, as the editor-in-chief of Lawfare, Lawfare does not practice checkbook journalism. And that is both because we're morally opposed to it and because when we spend money, it is donor money. And so we tend to be pretty frugal with it. I love the phrase checkbook journalism. Tyler, you're a great American, and thanks for joining us.
So one thing I will add to what Tyler said, there were a few things when we were writing our dispatch today that stood out to me more than maybe they did at the time in court. So there are things that I think go to things like knowledge or Trump's knowledge or intent. At one point they were talking to Pecker about, you know, he's had this long time professional and personal relationship with Trump, and he gives his perspective on Trump's, you know, observations he's made about Trump as a businessman and his business practices. And he kind of describes him as being very detail oriented and a micromanager. And then the prosecution also elicited testimony in which Pecker described being in Trump's office, and his assistant comes in and provides him with some invoices and checks to sign. And Pecker, you know, watches him very carefully, like examine or review these invoices before he signs the check. So I think that there's like little things that aren't the most newsy moments that are coming out in some of this testimony, but that could still kind of help, is helping the prosecution build some of the intent issues in terms of, you know, showing that Trump is someone who does look at the checks and invoices that he signs and that kind of thing. So that's one other small thing that I would know.
It's interesting. It's quite dissonant with our, mm-hmm. I mean, most people, including me, don't think of Trump as detail oriented. Right. In fact, they think of Trump as like, you know, orders the withdrawal of, signs the withdrawal from the Korean American Free Trade Agreement and just kind of leaves it on his desk and, you know, gets whisked away. And
there wasn't money on the table then, Ben.
Right. I mean,
that's the difference.
But it's really interesting because remember when Jim Comey testified about him, he's asked about his intelligence and, you know, he says, actually, he's smart. He's above average intelligence and he's, you know, it really does suggest that aspects of his persona really are just acts.
Yeah, but I do think that there's an element of it too that is maybe not, you know, there are stories about him getting fixated on certain things. So, I mean, the classified documents case, the whole, you know, my boxes thing, like him having this kind of obsession with the boxes, but my boxes theory of why Trump stole classified documents. But it's, you know, there's elements to his personality that have been publicly reported that I think does kind of fit with at least a micromanager kind of characterization of him. I do agree that, you know, calling Trump detail oriented was very surprising to me when we were sitting there listening in court.
If I could add, and one of those traits is that he watches his money. It's not like somebody that would give $35,000 a month and not know what he was paying for. And I'll just reference, there was a magazine before Anna was born called Spy Magazine. Do you remember they did a story once about where they sent very tiny checks to celebrities to see if they would cash them? And, you know, somebody would cash one for $2. And Trump cashed one for 13 cents.
to see who would
there's
task
his
them.
Signature, you know, yeah. that.
Which I think was the record, right?
I think it was, yeah.
I think that was the smallest check that was cashed.
I would also like to point out that Spy magazine once had the best ever advice column, which was called Ask the Nobelists. And people would write in asking for advice, and they would find some like aged Nobel Prize winner in chemistry or something to write a response, which was always, you know, sort of like not the sort of thing you would write in an advice column. Spy magazine was wonderful. And I believe, am I misremembering this, Roger, that it was founded by the guy who named, it was founded by Graydon Carter, right?
Graydon, Kurt Anderson, and a third guy whose name is slips my mind.
Yeah, but Graydon's significance to this is that he was the person who came up with one of the best ever nicknames for Trump, which was the
short-fingered vulgarian.
Yeah, the short-fingered vulgarian.
I just want to say that all of this really shows just like how deep into like 1980s New York you have to get in order to truly understand the dynamics of this prosecution.
Right. And by the way, that brings me to the subject of the building, which nobody has entirely done justice to how dingy and and sort of like 1980s. I mean, the building is actually from the 30s by the look of the deco the sort of WPA look of the murals downstairs, and outside. The building has this real 1980s New York not doing well, vibe to it, and it's spectacular, and it's exactly the venue that the first Trump trial should be in, notwithstanding subject matter or anything else.
It's also extremely cold, though. It is freezing right now, at least.
Really
I'm sure
hot.
In the summertime it'll be extremely hot, and I'll be complaining about that then.
But I did notice that when you stand outside the building and you look at the face of the building, this has got to be the largest public building I've seen in New York or Washington that has window air conditioners in a whole bunch of the windows, because they clearly, if they either don't have central air conditioning in
New York City,
or it is not functional.
They definitely don't, because I mean, at least in the courtrooms themselves, I'm pretty sure it is just whatever temperature it is outside is like what you have to deal with in the courtroom. So I'm sure Trump is, it's going to be very interesting when it eventually we hit like a 90 degree day at some point in like May or something, or June.
Yep.
I
have a solution to that, which is that I wear dog shirts to court. I don't know what Trump's solution is going to be. All right. From the hot courtroom to the very, what should be a hotter courtroom in South Florida, but is in fact one where very little happens. Roger, take us on a tour down to South Florida. What's going on?
Well, sort of a lot is happening, actually. She's trying to get out from under the redaction hell she's been in for a while, which is partly of her own making, but she's trying to get documents filed publicly in various ways. And I see now that she wants to have more hearings, but she can't hold the hearings until she gets these redaction issues figured out, so that she doesn't want to close the hearing, and she wants to be able to discuss the documents. So she's doing that now. Now, one thing she did on Friday was she ruled on three pretrial motions. And I mentioned last time that I thought she was going to deny them. and she did deny them. They were two bills of particulars being sought by De Oliveira and by Nauda, and then a motion to dismiss by being sought by Nauda. And I mentioned that they were they seemed easy. And she issued an 8-page ruling, and it's perfectly competent. But the thing that strikes me is it's actually quite over-researched. I'm putting together all the other rulings to this point. I see now, I think she's auditioning for an 11th Circuit seat. She has high aspirations, and so she wants to take her time to get everything correct, and you know, the citation and she sort of, she uses very elevated language, often to my subjective ear, stilted, some of the gimmickry of the legal profession, I think this is part of what's going on, and what's slowing things down is a combination of insecurity plus this high aspiration, and every ruling has to position her. And so many of them, not this particular one I'm talking about, show how what a hard-nosed textualist she is, and how plain meaning, and she'll try to insert sort of pithy phrases that sound a little like Chief Justice Rehnquist saying, you know, the way to stop discrimination on the base of race is stop discrimination. That sort of thing. And I think that's what's going on. And unfortunately, I think she's going to succeed in, we're not going to, this is not a flash in the pan. We're going to be hearing a lot about her. It's only time before the usual suspects, Professor Turley, Professor Calabresi come in and write a story about, if they haven't already, about how maligned she is, and she's brilliant, she's fine, you know. So this is part of what's going on. Obviously, I metamorphosed into Dr. Parloff's corner here with a little psycho,
yes,
a popular psych.
But quick technical correction. The quote that you used was Chief Justice Roberts, not Rehnquist.
It's still a bad line, though.
They both start with R, and one, they both chief justices and one clerk for the other. But I didn't want to leave that on the table. Go on, please. Okay.
So I think that probably where we're going at the moment is because Trump is on trial, she's going to try to do some of the stuff involving Nauta and De Oliveira. Nauta has a motion to dismiss based on prosecutorial misconduct, and we're beginning to get some of that stuff unsealed. So I think that's probably next in store. And what is obvious from the filings is that Stan Woodward, the lawyer for Nauta, and the special counsel have the worst relationship. There's real tension there. And that goes back, if you remember, to something that came out in the news right around the time of the indictment, which was allegedly something that happened back in August of, I think, 2022, when there was a meeting between Jay Bratt and three others, special counsel, and Woodward, and they were trying to convince him that it would be in Nauta's best interest to flip. And allegedly, Bratt brought up something about either the fact that Woodward was on this judicial nominating committee, but as Woodward remembers it, he brought up the fact that Woodward wanted to become a judge of the Superior Court of D.C. And so the negotiations to Woodward's ear had a pressuring quality that maybe it would be good for him if he could persuade his client to do this, and maybe it would be bad for him if he couldn't. And so there has been this undertow, and he never, Woodward doesn't bring it up for 9 months, but he brings it up on the eve of trial after there's a target letter, May 19th, 2023. Actually, Trump brings it up for the first time, one of Trump's lawyers, different lawyers at that time. And in the context of saying you need to, you know, have the OPR, the Office of Professional Responsibility, look into this, and you should delay any indictment until OPR makes an assessment. So it came up in the context of delay, but it doesn't mean it, you know, something didn't happen. And so some more documents relating to that dispute were unsealed this week. And I think we're moving toward, you know, probably hearing one of those motions to dismiss, that motion to dismiss, which may be a very nasty affair.
And what about SEPA Section 5? We're a national security site. We should be, you know, all over talking, speculating about what's going on in SEPA Section 5 briefing we don't have access to. And yet, here we are bereft.
Well, I was going to talk about and Section 5 next. There hasn't been much dispute about the national security documents. I mean, everyone has sort of agreed that those need to be sealed. So now the SEPA Section 5 notice is the next thing. I spoke about it last week. It's this central moment in a SEPA case where and a lot hinges on it, where the defendant says, okay, these are the classified documents I need to use to defend myself. And then, you know, this causes some delay while the prosecutors go back to the intelligence community, the stakeholders, and ask, how sensitive are these documents? How catastrophic would it be? And then they come back to the judge and say, these are inadmissible, and they have a hearing on that. And when that fails, they go to another hearing and say, well, maybe we can redact them or substitute or this or that. So the SCO has been, the special counsel's office has been trying to, originally it was set for November 15th. She lifted that deadline at the same time she lifted most deadlines in early November. And then immediately, special counsel tried to reschedule it because it's crucial. So on November 15th, they tried to reschedule it. And she said the next day, without waiting for any reply, no, I'm not rescheduling until we have a hearing March 1st, 3.5 months later, on to determine where to go. And so they had that hearing March 1st. They deliberated, they argued, and then 40 days later, she said, okay, I'm setting it for May 7th. And then 3 days later, Trump's people said, no, can't do it. You know, we're on trial. And of course, the fact that they were going to be on trial in New York was the subject of the hearing in March 1st. So it's not a new thing. So this motion to reconsider, in essence, by Trump of that date has been fully briefed since April 18th. So that's a week. And she has not rescheduled that. So that will be an important thing.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Before we go to audience questions, I want to close with Quinta, you had a piece in The Atlantic this week about the Access Hollywood tapes. In the interest of full disclosure, I'm just going to admit I haven't read it yet. And it is not because I am not interested in it. It's because I've had two Seders, a lot of travel back and forth between New York and Providence, Rhode Island, and D.C. And I actually know nothing about it except that it exists. So tell us about it. And what's the piece?
Thanks, Ben. You're forgiven. So this is it's an article. The title is "Trump's Misogyny is on Trial in New York," in The Atlantic, about sort of the role of Access Hollywood and that kind of, I would argue, chaotic and traumatizing period in the 2016 election and the role that that plays in the New York prosecution. So key to Bragg's argument has been that Trump was motivated to pay off Daniels in significant part because the Access Hollywood tape had just broken. He was worried about his standing with female voters and therefore was motivated to sort of try to quash this story that he thought might damage that further. Of course, the tape is arguably, I think, the most sort of visceral example that we have of what I would argue is Trump's contempt for women. And I think the Daniels case really brings that to the fore in a lot of ways, particularly in Daniels' own account of her interactions with him, which are pretty disturbing, frankly. She said she does not think of herself as a victim, that it was consensual, but there, if you listen to her 60 Minutes interview, it's pretty queasy. And also in how he's responded to her after she started talking about her experience, including insulting her looks and all kinds of other pleasant things. So essentially what I'm arguing is just that, you know, this is important context for understanding the dynamics in the New York trial. I think it's very much kind of the subtext underlying a lot of what is being discussed here. And I also think that you saw that come through during jury selection when you had a lot of jurors who said, you know, oh, I went to the Women's March. There's one really striking moment where a potential juror was asked if she followed politics. And she said, well, I know about President Trump because I'm female. So this is just kind of putting a cap on that. I will be very, very interested to see if Daniels testifies, what her testimony looks like, and whether any of this sort of emerges over the course of the trial in other ways.
All right, we are going to go to audience question.
Oh, wait. I have one little thing to say about Fulton County, actually.
Oh, yes. We have not checked in on Fulton County. Anna Bauer, Fulton County correspondent currently in exile in New York. What's going on?
I know, and it's very sad because I feel slightly underprepared today. There was a filing earlier today by Trump's team. And it's very interesting because I spoke to someone who's familiar with, you know, how these filings came about. It's I doubt that it's going to be just Trump's team who files something on it, but they filed today. But I spoke to someone who was familiar with kind of why this filing came about past the deadline. And it turns out that Judge McAfee had ordered supplemental briefing on this issue of whether this 1890 Supreme Court case called In re Loney could have application to, you know, the dismissal of any of these counts that relate to the filing of false documents in federal district court or to the chief judge of the federal district court. That's counts 14, 15, and 27 in the indictment. Two of them relate to either filing false documents or conspiracy to file false documents, insofar as the fake elector certificates were submitted to the chief judge of the Northern District Court of Georgia, which is the federal court. And then one of the counts relates to Eastman and Trump making filings in an election suit called Trump versus Kemp. And that's the filing that kind of, you know, claimed that there were 10,000 dead voters in Georgia and all of that. And so this old 1890s case by the United States Supreme Court, said that, you know, basically if someone perjures themselves in a tribunal that is a federal proceeding and that, you know, basically it only affects, the public justice of the federal government, then it is something that can't be prosecuted under or that the state court does not have jurisdiction to, you know, preside over. And so there's been a number of filings in this case. We spoke a few weeks ago about Kathy Latham had tried to cite this case to get her a part of the indictment related to the RICO charge struck from the indictment. But Judge McAfee refused to do that because she's not substantively charged with perjury. They're just saying that her perjury in federal court was a, you know, part of the overarching RICO conspiracy. So on those grounds, he said, you know, I'm not going to strike this. But here, these are, you know, substantive charges related to the filing of false documents to either in a federal court proceeding or to the chief judge of a federal court. And so it's very interesting that Judge McAfee has apparently ordered supplemental briefing on the impact of this case. It could mean nothing. It could mean something, but it certainly means that he's interested to hear what the parties have to say about it. I have not had the time today because we've been writing the New York piece to read all the case law that is cited in this filing. So I think it's something that we will maybe have to talk more in depth about next week, but did just want to flag that was a new development in Fulton County today. And I think we'll probably see more filings from other defendants who could be affected, because it includes some of these charges for the filing of false documents. It's not just Trump. It's, you know, Sean Still, Kathy Latham, David Schaefer, Rudy Giuliani. Like a lot of these folks would be impacted if this case is something that Judge McAfee ends up saying, yeah, I think it applies and that these counts should be dismissed. So we will see what happens.
One other Fulton County question. It feels to me like we are awfully near that point at which, I forget whether it's 28 days or what about thereabouts, where the Georgia Court of Appeals should be letting us know whether it's going to hear the disqualification matter. Do we know where that is?
Yeah, so I would need to look at my calendar to tell you the exact date, but I believe that it is within the next week that we are likely to hear a decision. The actual number of days they have is 45 days, but because of some other rules that aren't the, you know, statutory rule, they tend to make decisions, you know, within like around the 30-day mark. So I think that we will probably see something pretty soonish here from the Georgia Court of Appeals in terms of whether they will take up the disqualification denial by Judge McAfee.
All right. We're going to go to audience questions. I'm going to try to get as many of them in as possible. So I'm going to read them fast, and people, let's do brief answers to the extent that we can. Also, if you are one of the people who requested to read your own question, which I always prefer, please
stand by, and the Lawfare, our producer, the other Anna, Anna Hickey, will invite you to read it. So please respond when she pings you. Catherine asks, Jack Goldsmith's 422 article says that the Supreme Court will find this a hard case for impacting future presidential power. And quote, thus, if the court in Trump v. United States rules that Trump lacks criminal immunity, it might need to consider the applicability and constitutionality issues, since these generally worded criminal laws at issue do not expressly refer to the president. And Catherine asks, if the Supreme Court takes this route, will the trial court be able to proceed, or will this require further delays? I think the answer to this question is that it depends how they take this route. So you could take this route and, as Roger said, remand it to the lower court for proceedings to think about this issue, and then those are appealable, and then you could have a pretty protracted set of subsequent stuff. You could also do it the way Quinta described earlier, and say you remand it for findings in evidentiary matters in trial, and those are very different. I suspect you could also do it a third way, although this also fits into the category of Lawfare contributor content that I haven't read yet because of said earlier craziness, so I'm a little bit behind here. I think you could probably do it a third way, which is just to say we decide that the president doesn't have immunity, and we don't decide anything else. For example, whether there's a clear statement rule that requires that certain statutes be read not to apply to the president, and you let Trump argue that in the district court, presumably Judge Chutkan, given her ruling on immunity, would reject that, and that becomes a subsequent basis for appeal after the after conviction, if conviction happened. So that's my gut. Roger, Quinta, do you have other views?
No.
No? Okay. Tony asks, in opening statements on Monday, we learned that the predicate crime for the felony enhancement in New York is conspiracy to influence an election or something like that. What are the elements of that crime under New York state law? How do we think those criteria apply in this case? And how does the defense's claim that there's no crime here stack up to the conspiracy allegation? So this is an easy one. The premise of the question is incorrect. The predicate crime, or what in New York law is called the object crime, that is required for the step up, is not conspiracy to interfere with an election. And in fact, as I noted before, the prosecutor, Matthew Colangelo, repeatedly referred to a conspiracy to influence the election that is in fact not charged. And it's not clear to me what he calls it an illegal scheme. It's not clear to me what law it is said to be violating.
And so Ben, I can speak to this.
Yeah.
So I'm in the process of putting together a Lawfare article right now, walking through this. I do think it is unclear. So right. So the underlying offense is business records falsification, which is stepped up from a misdemeanor to a felony by an intent to commit another crime and aid and conceal the commission thereof. There are a number of other crimes that Bragg has listed. One of them is New York election law 17-152, which outlaws, and I quote, conspiring to promote or prevent the election of any person to a public office by unlawful means. If you look at Bragg's filings, and at Justice Mertrand's ruling on Trump's omnibus motion to dismiss, it becomes clear that the unlawful means in question are the other object offenses that Bragg has pointed to step up that misdemeanor offense to the felony. Those other object offenses being federal campaign finance law, tax fraud under federal, state, and local law, and finally, misdemeanor falsification of business records, not by Trump, but by AMI, David Pecker's company, and by Michael Cohen in setting up the shell company to pay Stormy Daniels. This is very complicated. Right, but we will have a piece.
Yeah, so I'm perplexed by this because Colangelo's argument at trial is that the scheme, like this is an argument for why the step up applies. And I think I read Justice Merchant's rejection of the motion I actually think he was quite compelling on that. That's why the step up applies to the falsification of business records. But Colangelo is saying something else. He's saying that the underlying, that there is a conspiracy that begins immediately before the election, immediately after Trump declares his candidacy to unlawfully affect the election using these catch and kill schemes. And he repeatedly refers to this right. as a conspiracy or as an illegal scheme. And he never articulates to the jury, at least, what the basis for calling that illegal is.
Right. So I guess so what I'm saying is that the illegality is the federal campaign finance violation, which Cohen has pleaded to. AMI has reached a non-prosecution agreement with the Justice Department and also an agreement with the FEC as to the illegality of its actions. So the argument is essentially that the payments to Daniels and to Karen McDougal constituted illegal campaign contributions under FICA, federal campaign finance law, which were then also not reported. So that's an additional violation. That is the illegality. And then New York election law 17152 is the conspiracy statute that allows Bragg to point to that as a conspiracy.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's right. And then also, Quinta, am I correct that it...
That's correct.
Again, it's one of those things where it could be two theories. It could be the campaign finance theory that makes it that's the unlawful means, but it also could be the tax theory that makes it the unlawful means. So we've had this string of like, there's the falsification, there's the, another attempt to commit another crime. And then from there, then you go to, you have to do the unlawful means for the election conspiracy, and that's another crime.
Right. And it kind of loops back.
So, right.
I'm going to make a chart.
Yeah.
All right.
Can I try to make this even more convoluted?
Please.
I have a theory for why they would prefer this state law, election law. It's called 17-152 of the election law, the one about conspiring to promote the election of any person by unlawful means. Because, if you go straight, if you say the object crime is the federal crime, there is this argument, oh, it can't be a federal crime, and then you get, there's that thread. With this, even though you're still talking about a federal crime, the state crime, 17-152, has a definitions section. And its definition section says, this chapter shall govern the conduct of all elections, blah, 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 at which voters of the state of New York may cast a ballot for the purpose of electing an individual to any party position or electing an individual to any federal, state, county, city, town. So it's explicit about including elections for federal office. I think maybe that's why they sort of would prefer to go this route. It's another... It's a little stronger than going directly to the federal crime. That's just a theory.
All right. Jeff asks, can a judge take into account a defendant's behavior in prior trials when considering contempt sanctions? And how could a judge's contempt order being overturned on appeal impact the trial? So the second question is easy, which is that the jury would not be informed if Trump is held in contempt and would similarly not be informed if Trump were if that contempt order were reversed. remember that the entire system of a trial is designed to control very exquisitely what information a jury does and does not see. This jury's job is to decide not anything related to Trump's behavior with respect to the court, but whether these specific events charged in the indictment took place. They will not receive information about his potential contempt. Now, could a judge take into account prior behavior? I don't think so. The relevant issue here is there is a court order. Is the court order been violated? And what is the relevant question, unless it were argued as a sort of pattern of practice of defiance of court orders in general, so throw the book at him here. That is not what the prosecution is saying here, and it is not what the judge will do. Did I get any of that wrong?
No, that sounds right. But if he keeps doing it and violating the same order over and over and over, then yes, right. The judge will, in this case, you know, not in previous cases, not in D.C. or Florida or something, but if he keeps violating Mershon's order, then yeah, the punishment should go up.
So Josh asks, one, do we know what other crimes are being used to elevate the falsification of business records, misdemeanors to felonies? And what are folks' guesses about whether Trump will end up with any jail time or other form of confinement for his violations of the gag order? The answer is we do know what crimes are being used to elevate. Quinta articulated them before. In the omnibus motion to dismiss, the Justice Mershon ruled on four object bump-up charges, and they are state campaign finance law, federal campaign finance law, and state tax law. There was a fourth, which he rejected and forbade the prosecution from using, which involved basically falsification by way of causing other falsifications, and he thought it was too attenuated. Does anybody have anything else to add to that? And does anybody have guesses about what, particularly Anna, since you were in the room for this, what do you think he's going to do with, and the prosecution didn't ask for jail time on this. What do you think he's going to do?
Yeah, I mean, look, the prosecution didn't ask for jail time. What they asked for was the maximum statutory fine per, alleged violation. So that'd be like $1,000 times 10. Correct, Quinta?
Yeah, that's right. So yes. So this is under New York judiciary law. The cap on for financial penalty is $1,000. I just want to add that is distinct from the civil contempt law that Justice Engoron was using in the civil fraud case, which does not have a cap. So that's why Engoron was able to fine him, I think it was $15,000 for contempt in those instances, just to clarify.
Yeah, so they requested this, financial penalty, but then also said he should be, admonished, required to take the post down, and then also warned that future violations could result in, detention or, that kind of thing. So being jailed. So I think that here I we're not going to see him now go to jail. But I do get the sense that Justice Mershon was taking these posts very seriously. He seemed like he may be willing to find Trump in contempt. But I would expect that it would be, the kind of thing where he admonishes him and allows this financial penalty request. But I just don't see Trump going to jail over this.
I wondered if the questioner was also asking about the penalty if he's convicted for the crime itself. Was that?
Yeah, it was not encompassed in the question.
Oh, okay, sorry.
But that's I would think Trump would almost certainly have at least some jail time if he were convicted on 34 felony counts. I don't think it would be a long time, but, you know, normal would be in the 1 to 1.5 year range here. And I do think he would likely serve some time, particularly given his daily rants against the judicial system and clear remorselessness. That is precisely the sort of thing that a court takes into account. The estimable John Hawkinson has a question and is appearing in person to ask it. You're a great American, sir. Welcome.
Thanks, Ben. Didn't mean to jump your cue. So this is not specific to the New York Trump case, but the scientist in me is really troubled how jurors and alternates are assigned in order. Why should the first 12 be real jurors and the next 6 be alternates? And why should the attorneys and the parties and the press and public be privy to that information? It just seems like it can slip out inadvertently, and then any juror who's familiar with trial practice in the court or who reads the press or talks to a friend can figure out who's real and who's an alternate, and that diminishes the value of being an alternate. Wouldn't it be better to assign them by a random draw, known only the judge and the clerk, or maybe the parties, until the end of the trial? So why do courts do it this way? And kind of the same question for the foreman, if that's the number one juror, which I think it is in this case.
Roger, do you have thoughts on this? You've spent a lot of time with trials.
The last federal trials I saw, they did keep secret who the alternates were, both from us and from them. And the idea to keep it, you know, if you know you're an alternate, you can sort of begin to doze off if you think I'm not really going to get on this. So there is that some do go through that process. I don't know why New York doesn't.
Yeah, practice varies a lot from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. The last jury that I was on in Washington, D.C., we picked our own foreman. New York practice. But I think your argument, as to the unfortunate possible consequences of this process are spot on. And I don't think having jurors be knowledgeable of exactly the role they're going to play relative to each other or relative to the process is necessarily the best thing in the world. So I tend to agree with you about that. All right, I have two questions. I do not want to end this live stream without addressing. The first is, so let me get the easy one out of the way, which is from Josh Knight. Is it possible to get chat transcripts from the Riverside sessions? And the answer is, I have no idea. We will look into it and get back to you. The second one is from Thing 2, and I'm just going to read you this in its entirety, and anybody who has thoughts should respond. Okay, I really hate to say this, but the more I hear about this, and not from Trump, but from the likes of you all, the less this thing seems like a crime. Paying your mistresses to keep quiet is legal. Agreeing with publishers to do whatever is legal, suborning some fairly minor over-the-limit campaign contributions is okay, maybe a misdemeanor. We're like talking a few $100,000, not like Clarence Thomas level shit. And the records thing is literally a misdemeanor. And everybody keeps talking about Cohen going to jail, but he pled guilty. He might have won if he'd gone to trial, so that's not really evidence of anything. So they shove 2 misdemeanors through a loophole that turns them into a felony. As pure as my Prague Dem heart is in hatred of the former guy, I'm kind of coming to agree with him on this one. Each of you take 1 minute and not one more than 1 minute to respond.
Well, this is the whole issue with going forward with this offense, and Mark Pomerantz called it the zombie charge. They kept rejecting it and bringing it back. Apparently, Cy Vance, according to Pomerantz's book, would not have gone forward solely with this. This is why so many people wish this had not been the first case. It so pales by comparison to all the others. So I guess I don't quite feel as bad as you do about it, but I feel pretty bad.
I'd be curious
to hear your thoughts.
You go next.
What I would say is it is definitely true that the legal theory here is kind of tangled. And I say that having spent the last week or so trying to figure out which way is up. I think it is also true that a lot of the borderline contempt that sort of law professors and former federal prosecutors have treated it with is odd. And perhaps speaks to the fact that this is a state case rather than a federal case. It is notable that a lot of people turned on a dime from saying, you know, this was terrible, it was awful, legal theory made no sense, yada, yada, to embracing it wholeheartedly when it turned out it might be the only trial before the election. So make of that what you will.
We're not going to name names or anything on that, are
no.
we?
No. We're going to be very professional.
Just checking.
But I do think that that is a big component of it. I think the other thing is that I have increasingly come to think, and I may write something sketching this out, that a lot of what we're seeing here is Bragg's office kind of picking up the baton from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, which was investigating Trump for the same campaign finance violations for which it charged Cohen. And which never brought those charges for reasons that have never been clear. I think there's good reason to think that a lot of that may have been they simply didn't want to charge Trump in 2019 because he was the sitting president. And in 2021, they thought, why are we going to bother with this? There are more important things on the table. And so they kind of just let the whole matter go. That leads to this weird situation where the underlying FICA violations are really, I think, the foundation of the case, and yet themselves are not charged. Like, that is weird. I don't want to deny that. It is strange. I do think it's kind of a hole. But it may exist in part because of Trump's own ability to kind of cloak himself in the office of the presidency and benefit from that immunity. And so whether or not you think that that explains it all and you know, means that we should give Bragg a pass, or is just a backstory for a bad situation, I don't know, but that's kind of where I'm at.
All right, I'm just going to say the following about this, which is this is exactly the same case as the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky case. Exactly. I mean, the details are different, but ethically, morally, you have lawful but very unflattering sexual activity by a person who's either the president or seeking the presidency that would be very embarrassing if it came out. And so the person in question takes non-legal steps in order to cover it up. And what I would say is if you thought the Bill Clinton case was trivial, and many people did, you should be consistent. And this this thing too is reflecting that this is, you know, not worth taking, you know, whatever else you may think about Trump, not worth taking somebody down over. I am puritanical about this sort of thing. I took the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky stuff pretty seriously, thought it was worth investigating. I did not think it was worth impeaching a president over, but I did support the investigation, and I am being consistent in the other direction. I think I don't like it when public officials corrupt the judicial system. I don't like it when public officials doctor the books to, or would be public officials to cover up their sexual misconduct. Some people are into that. I'm not into that. And this is why we have prosecutorial discretion. And I would say there are definitely prosecutors who wouldn't have brought this case. And that's a respectable decision. And Alvin Bragg is a prosecutor who brought this case, and that's a respectable decision. And I am reserving judgment, frankly, which side I am on in that until I've seen the whole case. We are going to leave it there. Anna Bauer, you missed your chance to say how you feel about this.
I will update. I want to see some more and read Quinta's piece on the various step-up theories before I really have a hot take on it. So we'll see.
That's called a not hot take. If you wait to study the law carefully, and learn something about it before giving your take, that is, it is no longer, by definition, a hot take.
Well, I'll give you my lukewarm take next week.
We are going to leave it there. Anna Bauer, Roger Parloff, Quinta Jurassic, and Tyler McBrien, thank you all for joining us this week. Remember, folks, Lawfare is a reader-funded organization. If you support this kind of live stream, you should really become a material supporter of Lawfare. Or, in the alternative, go to our GiveButter fundraising for this project, the Trump Trials coverage, and help me pay these guys' salaries. They need to eat too. Thank you to Anna Hickey, who is managing the live stream today, and we will be back tomorrow with two live streams, one of which I will be hosting, or maybe neither of which. Maybe I'll be on, and the other of which will be about the immunity case, and that will be spectacular. We will see you then. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare Materials supporter using our website, lawfaremedia.org/support. You'll also be able to pose questions to our panel and become part of our conversation by joining our webinars on Riverside, which are available only to our supporters. The podcast is edited by the one, the only Jen Patia, and your audio engineer this episode was Anna Hickey of Lawfare. As always, thanks for listening.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.